I'd like to welcome everybody tonight to our last series for this semester of the Michigan Science Fiction Writers Series. And we have a really dynamic speaker tonight, Kathy Koja from the Detroit area. And without more announcement of who she is, I'll let her take over.
Thank you. I'm not really dynamic, though. Leslie was just being nice. I'm semi-dynamic. I have a lot of working parts, and some of them are working. What people usually do is read first and talk after. So, and you'll see if you have anything to say when I'm done reading, and if you have anything you want to talk about afterwards. The story that I'm going to read now comes from my short fiction collection called Extremities. And one of the reasons I chose to read this is it's the only story that I've ever written that's set in Michigan, in kind of the Detroit I-75 corridor. Oddly enough, I didn't notice this until somebody pointed it out to me, but it is the only story that's set here in town where I live. And it's called Bird Superior, and I'm going to read it to you now. In the instant before the plane hit, he thought about the rabbit. Ball of stumbling fur, right hind leg wrenched brisk and brutal, the stupid, almost cartoon wideness of its eyes. And he, swerving, trying not to hit it too. Again, failing, the bloody fluff of its tail. What a thing to think about just before you die. Cartoon character, him too, eyes as comically wide. Where am I? A hospital. What hurt? Nothing, so far as he could tell, but that could just be drugs. Unless he was dead and this was one of those out-of-body experiences. He seemed to be in his body, but how could you actually tell? If I can get someone to notice me, he thought, then I'll know I'm alive. Green and baggy, white coat, stethoscope shine, and cold brown hands, and his own timid voice, excuse me, excuse me, yes, businesslike friendly, a not impatient smile. Mr. Kidler, John, how are you feeling, John? Alive, then, and with a name, even. Fine, he said. Am I hurt? Well, you sustained a head injury, John. You've got some stitches in your scalp, right across here, touching a numb line across, presumably, his head. He could see part of the gesture, but felt none of it. Do you remember very much of what happened to you? I remember the rabbit. No. I remember the plane was in some kind of trouble, something about hydraulics, hopefully, like a student offering information to a notoriously exacting professor. The flight attendants told us to assume crash positions, and I did, and what? Nothing. A small grayness from there to here, the width of a scalp wound. I'm afraid that's all I really remember. That's all right. It's pretty common. Pen light in the eyes, were his pupils responding as pupils should? Blood pressure cuff, the gentle strobe of the stethoscope as the overhead light brightened. It's a built-in safeguard with this kind of accident trauma. Pause for pulse. You'll remember when you're ready, probably within a week or two. Maybe more, maybe less. Different people react differently. Chart in hand and writing, absent nod of reassurance. It's nothing to worry about. Your main problem will be some discomfort in the area where the stitches are, but a couple aspirin every few hours should take care of that. Will I be going home soon? We're going to keep you overnight, keep an eye on you. It's SOP for head injuries. Putting the chart back, patting the metal U of the bed frame as if it were an extension of his body that could be soothed by touch. If you have any problems, give a holler. And gone, and he left alone to trace, with clandestine, embarrassed fingers, the line of stitches. His only evidence of cheated death. An airline person came the next morning, bright, anxious smile. How are you feeling today, Mr. Kidler? For a minute, he thought the woman was a nurse, until he saw her blue suit, her chipper little tie. Nurses don't wear ties. Chipper voice, too. He would, of course, be flown first class to his destination city. What was his destination city? Detroit. As soon as he was ready to travel, yes. Not, note, well enough to travel. What happened to the other people on the plane? He asked. Was anyone hurt? No, thank goodness. Most of the passengers had escaped serious injury. The plane itself sustained some structural damage. She was talking like a press release, but obviously nervous enough to shit water. He took her card, let her go. Exactly 1 hour later, another airline representative, this time definitely legal, was on the phone. This one was harder to get rid of, but he managed. Afterwards called the nurse, the real nurse. Can I get an aspirin, please? Bitter, dry taste in the back of his mouth. He slept most of the day, not drugged, but simply tired. The body exhausted, maybe, by the furious inner work of healing. No one told him that, but it made sense. The next day, they told him he could go home. The airline said they were holding a first-class seat. They were sending an airline limo. Would 12:30 be convenient? 12:30, he said, would be fine. It was not until he was actually at the gate that he considered the concept of fear of flying, suggested to him by the mournful avidity of a fellow passenger, inevitably noting the Frankenstein panache of his stitches, his partially shaven head. Aren't you scared to fly now? And he smiled, a dry, modest little grin, but there was actually nothing to it. Fear of crashing, yes. Perhaps a new appreciation of the force of gravity, but he felt no apprehension at the idea of flying itself. Felt, in fact, nothing at all. Perhaps if he could remember the crash, things might be different. But things were things, and he settled in his seat, buckled in, closed his eyes. He had done it a million times before, though not, of course, in first class. At work, he was a minor celebrity. It wore off before the stitches came out, which was fine with him. What was the drama? A car wreck would have been worse. Certainly that roadkill rabbit thought so. Roadkill rabbit, brought to you by Firestone Tires. If it had been a bird now, it might have lived, able to take wing in the crucial second, able to find escape by rising. Pigeons did it all the time, blind, nonchalant waddle before the oncoming wheels, and just when the car seemed inescapable, they rose, like swaggering preteens before an exasperated driver. Let's see how close we can get. He'd begun to watch the pigeons when he drove. They seemed to like roosting in underpasses, though you never saw them on side streets. On side streets, it was sparrows, but they were a prudent group, skittish at the slightest sound of wheels. He liked to watch the incongruous seagulls in from Lake St. Clair, stealing garbage from the fast food dumpsters. Sometimes he saved the dry rind of his hamburger bun for them, maybe a couple of fries, the little ones nuked to stucco at the bottom of the container. His head itched where the stitches had been, where the new hair grew. It wasn't growing in quite right, not coarse and grayish brown like before, but downy. He frowned at it after showers and mirrors and then forgot about it. Still, he had no memory of the crash, though once he thought he dreamed of it. A smell like smoking plastic, the shrill, staticky hum of the flight attendant's voice. The dream caused him no particular dread, left no larger residue of remembrance. He told his doctor about it. She was a big woman who didn't take shit from anybody and didn't believe in anything, including medicine. So what, she said. Did it start your head hurting again? No? Then forget about it. She told him to take aspirin, and if he kept having dreams, write them down and sell them to the movies. Terror on Flight 505, she said, one man's story. In the mornings, he heard the birds, not soft and sweet as he had always thought of birdsong, the idea of birdsong, but sharp, the efficient language of those without small talk. They woke him up too early, but he didn't mind. He even considered getting a window feeder, but was put off by the idea of white stains on the side of the house. All of this changed when he began to fly. It was nothing he noticed right off. You don't wake up in the morning and decide you're going to fly, not even if you're the kind of person who has always dreamed of that quintessential freedom, which he emphatically was not. At first he thought it was some sort of horrible delayed reaction, an insidious psychosis taken hallucinatory root. Standing there in the cold morning driveway, bare feet an inch from the concrete as his lazy arms waved, what the hell am I doing? 2 inches, 3, his arms in perfect balance, his weight distributed and accounted for without the slightest thought, what the hell is wrong with me? Crazy. He stopped his arms moving and dropped lightly to the balls of his feet. Quick loping walk to the front door, stood trembling inside. He drove to work with the windows shut, afraid somehow that he might pull over in traffic, attempt to fly through the fumy air of rush hour. Whee, look at me! Birdsong next morning was still completely incomprehensible, and he was grateful, less so for the nagging sense not of memory lost, but of thoughts inaccessible, profound changes made in those blank moments, the fruit of which he was only now experiencing. Was he? Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the Birdman. Without thinking, absent flapping in the shower, only noticing when the drain water did not lap as usual at his ankles. Blowing his hair dry, a sudden suspicious peer in the mirror, that downy patch right in front. Oh God, oh for God's sakes, don't say it. Don't even say it out loud. There was no idea in him to tell anyone, share this delusion, even to prove that that was all it was. Frightening enough, the idea that he might be going quietly, post-traumatically mad. But what if it were true? What if he were really able to fly? By the power vested in me by a near-fatal aviation accident, I now pronounce you bird superior. Forget about it. Just forget about it. So much time spent then in wasted nervous speculation, the guilty staring out of windows at the shadows of circling birds. His work not so much suffering as, yes, grounded, the simplest problems taking longer and longer to even comprehend, much less solve. The daily equation of life now more riddle than plain sum, and he asked his boss for a long weekend and got it. Packed a gym bag and went up north. The interstate was visual white noise, landmarks he passed so often he need never check them again to know his way. Styrofoam cup of coffee, some stale chips. He drove without stopping. A campground, finally. He had been there many times, first with family, then buddies, and now standing by the hot hood of his car, the sun gone down and all the birds abed. He slept in his car. No one there would check. It wasn't that kind of park. In the morning, the stale reek of the log cabin restroom, washing his face to the furious dawn accompaniment of 1,000 birds, or at least it seemed so, so many calling out at once. Barefoot, casual stride into the woods, surely it was too early for anyone watching, any bored or curious eyes, and he stood, suddenly sheepish, and as suddenly businesslike, right. You came all the way out here, now do it. Rising. Tremoring arms, a nervous, airless excitement mixed with a healthy horror of his apparently unconditional surrender to the strange, but he was doing it, he really was. He was flying. 5, maybe 15, maybe 18 feet off the ground, clumsy in the trees, the questions falling away with the ground below. There were maybe answers, but he would never make it past maybe, so. His arms got tired more quickly than he had imagined, but of course it made its own sense. Of course muscles tire. He wanted bravado to land on a branch, but found himself unable to judge which might bear his weight. Too far up to quibble, so he chose instead the safer option of the ground. Stood shivering with cooling sweat in the sudden shade of a tree whose topmost branches he had only just inspected, marveling suddenly on the true nature of perspective from a perspective that no one else could share. Of course, there was no chance of duplicating this stunt back home in the neighborly confines of one-story houses and sensible streetlights. He must do all his aviating here and now. So he rested a while, hiked deeper, found a spot where he could see anyone coming. And why not? Circling up in the green, the air so much different there in ways perhaps that, groundbound, he could never have believed. He stayed up as long as his muscles dared, then, with bumbling, exquisite caution, found a branch, a lower branch than he wanted, but one that looked substantial, and perched. No one saw him, no birds approached him, though he saw plenty of spoor, feathers enough to last a lifetime. At dusk, he made his final approach, prudent in the last of the light. Too hard to fly in the dark without radar. If he were a bat now. You're an idiot, he told himself, perversely proud, rubbing aching biceps as he marched himself back to his car. Idiot, that's what you are. He was too tired to drive, too sore to spend another night on the car's front seat. Back by the interstate, there were motels, and he found one. Slept so hard he woke sweating, then slept again. The weekend was all work, delightful, exhausting. It was amazing all there was to know. How in God's name did real birds do it? Instinct, of course, for he was learning the hard way, the hit and miss way. But then again, he didn't have to eat grubs either. When he got into the car for the trip home, he wondered, could I make it there flying? Could I? No, reluctantly. No, not enough stamina. Not yet. And then shook his head at himself, amazed that one weekend could have sown such holes in his common sense. Do you think you're invisible? Or don't you think a flying man is unusual enough to stop traffic, even on I-75? "Idiot," he called himself again, less kindly now, for he preferred his first reaction. He did not want to have to think in groundling terms. All the drive home, he memorized the past days, the pure lack of not only care, but the thought for care. Perhaps the feeling was that it was all feeling, no thoughts beyond the physical. Could it really be as simple as that? But if that were so, wouldn't, say, puberty be holy? Wouldn't the silent squeal of orgasm, the grunt and strain of a bowel movement, be just as pure? Was there nothing mystical here to be had? Nothing deeper than sheer surface fact? Epiphany, love it or leave it. It was hard that night to sleep in his own bed. He roiled the covers, the silent, weary toll of the bedside digits making him more tired still, but luring sleep no closer. And at last, he said, to calm himself, he gave in. A gentle, stately indoor flight, once around the ceiling and watch those turns. Mindful of the frustrating low bridge doors, he flew all around the house twice. Arms alive, body soothed by the comfortable ache of muscles rehearsing newly learned tasks, he flew until his eyes would not stay open, then perched atop the metal storage cabinet in the laundry room and fell to peaceful sleep. Wake, early as now as usual, in some high spot. The fat overhead ledge of kitchen cupboards, the welcoming bookcase top. Eat breakfast, eggs over ironically. Drive to work while playing placid the new game. Distance calculated in air miles. How long would it take to get to, say, Atlanta from here? How about Phoenix? How about Seattle? How about Paris? You think you're ready for a transatlantic flight? He knew there were birds who did that very thing, flew unimaginable migratory distances, curlews or swallows or something. He didn't know the species. His new state of being had not led to any passion for birding. Imagine going back to Capistrano every year and being glad about it. At lunch, he continued his dumpster custom, finished each workday with a sense not of a job well done, but a loan of time now completed for this day. Fortunately, he was a patient man. How much money would it take to live for a year flying? Always assuming, of course, no capture, no eventual cage. This much? How long will it take to work for it? Okay. And always at night, the solo flights around the house. He was expert by now at ducking his head. Such a specialized ability, but no real need to be proud of it. Birds did it all the time. He still did not recall the plane crash, doubted now he ever would, certain that the memory was given in trade for what he had now, this elegant skill. Did it matter? Certainly not. He had blundered somehow into far the better of the deal. Had at times, in fact, a lurking feeling of unease. Would it somehow be repossessed? And answered himself, hopefully not while airborne, but knew in the calm secret silence of his mind that even if that were so, he would not care or mourn it. What was living, after all, without this gift? The familiar pattern of the carpet beneath him, stained like a flight plan, the dust in unexpected places. His orbit was small, but he cherished every inch of it. Once a month, the longer journeys, exquisite in their furtive challenge, building up those chest muscles, learning to taste the oncoming change of weather like a creature born to it. In no way was it reversion. He was definitely moving up. What friends he had at work in the neighborhood, he had left behind almost from the start. There was no way to share this, and there was nothing else he cared to share. He was pleasant, perhaps more distant than before, but people notice less than we believe, their full attention a tithe not lightly paid. He traded on it in an absent way. Mowing the grass, a casual wave, a morning pleasantry here and there, already so far away. The bank balance growing, but not quickly enough. He sold some things. He would never need them now anyway. How much you want for that snowblower? Yeah? Leaf bagger for sale, too. What are you up to, John, moving to Florida? His smile, pleasant smile. It said, who, me? In the dark, up above the kitchen floor, seeing in memory to come the sweep of his arms, oars of flesh as he moved through the air. Sizzle of the sun above, much closer now. How wonderful it would be to fly at night. Far safer, but though he had considered it with obsessive care, even armed with his new expertise, it was regrettably impossible. He simply did not have the eyesight for it, and a light was out of the question. What's that, Earl? I don't know, but we better shoot it down. He had no intention of ending his flight in some backlot trophy slump. Dawns, it would have to be, and careful, oh, fanatically careful day flights, staying low and rural. He had even designed a backpack device, matchstick contraption of balsa and thinnest synthetic silk, the kind hang gliders use. If absolutely caught and cornered, he would give it to them, remember a show of vast reluctance, and then with luck escape. He was going to need luck no matter what, but it was not a dismaying observation, nor gleeful. He neither sought nor feared risk. He simply knew he would require some luck, would do what he could to make sure it wasn't much. He was still a practical man. And then came a night where, waking perhaps an hour before it was needful, he knew it was time. Knew it with the thoughtless, inarguable certainty of instinct, beyond sense common or uncommon. Down, readying himself, shower and food, a step beyond each action, a pace removed, excited not in any outward way, but with a fierce good shiver at his core. Did real birds feel this way the night before migration? Methodically, but with trembling hands, he gathered all he would need, shut off the water, checked and locked the windows, strapped to his back the sly constructed fakery, its metal D-rings, official looking, unnecessary touch, thinly tinkling as he stepped onto the porch and locked the door. He even remembered to put in the mailbox the stamped letters requesting shutoff, phone, gas, electricity. The house was paid for, it would stand empty until he needed it. But to see it, illuminated by the cool swirl of headlights as he backed down the driveway, it seemed, felt, deserted, abandoned as a nest lies empty. He would not be coming back there again. It was a longer drive than perhaps was needed, but no matter what the end would be, he would begin with caution. He would start out right. Leaving the car at the airport was, he thought, both clever and symbolic. Obviously a planned departure, they would say, the man simply up and left. The airport lay surrounded not by city but fields. Beside the pimply cluster of Red Roof Inns and rent-a-car services, there was little else but a smattering of homes, just blacktop throwbacks to a time when people preferred to live without noise. Birds probably felt the same way. Dawn soon, but not too soon. He could be, would be, well on his way by then. Hesitating, the insistent tremor already begun, clamor of muscles wanting to begin. Still his eyes sought landmarks, still the nervous pre-flight shuffle. What was he waiting for? Faintly on the air, the smell of jet fuel, remembering all at once a hard, identical reek, some woman in the seat before him saying, "Jesus, Jesus," and the unhappy shriek of something metal bending past all reasonable limits, his testicles trying to crawl into his throat. And if I could fly, this wouldn't be happening. No, not exactly so. Not even close enough for paraphrase. But it got him laughing, and the laugh got him moving, rising. Hard downward strokes, and he rose, gaining altitude. Prudence far and away from the plane's heedless, murderous thunder. Skimming higher and higher, dark enough still for indulgent concealment. Maybe a trifle self-indulgent, but he was off on a great adventure. He owed a little to himself. Below him, the sluggish glimmer of vehicles, still few at this time. Were there rabbits running across that road? Too far, too high up to tell, and that was anyway a problem for the ground. Let those who live there find an answer. No answers needed here, for here there were no questions, between the glide of the clouds beneath him and the bite of the windy stars. You know, it occurs to me that I have another story that I would like to read as well. It's very short. And since this was a story about someone who got his wish, even though he didn't know that he had made a wish, I want to read another story from Extremities. And the story is called Bondage. And it's about people getting their wishes. She was shaped like sculpture, high bones, high forehead, long fingers silver cool against his skin as they lay side by side in the deep four-poster. princess bed draped in lace and gauze, and don't ever buy me a ring, she said. I don't like them. Even her voice, as calm and sure as metal. Why not, he said. They're bondage gear. Bondage, sure, like a wedding band, right? And her shrug, half a smile, one elbow rise to reach for her drink. That long white back, faint skeleton trail of bones, and what do you know about bondage? Her smile wider now, a canine flash. B&D, S&M. You ever do that, any of that? Have you, he thought. No, he said, I'm not into pain. It's not about pain, she said. Or anyway, it doesn't have to be. Bondage and discipline, tapping his chest for emphasis. Who's on top? She drank what was left in the glass, set it back on the floor. Climbed atop him. Like now, she said. Her taste of perfume, a faintest salt. Long legs hooked high above his hips, strong and growing stronger. Head straining back as if she would twist that long white body into a circle, bend it like sculpture, like metal and stone. And she was looking at him and almost smiling, lips spread to show those little pointed teeth. Not so bad, was it, she said, woman superior? But that's not the same thing, he said, still breathless. Not the same thing at all. Next day's dinner, some Tex-Mex place she loved. Plastic cacti, the waiters in 10-gallon hats, and reaching for her bag beneath the table. Reaching and a box, gift box, embossed black on black. Secret pleasures, and here, she said, with half a smile, for you. What's this for, he said. No reason. Go on, open it. And he did. Something soft and limp inside and curious, he unfolded that softness, spread it flat on the table between them. Supple white leather oval. No true eyes, gill slit where the mouth should be, and pretty cool, isn't it, she said. Tangle of black strings, one black grommet on each side, simple as desire itself. Do you like it? Where'd you get this? The box in hand again, examination, and from a sex store, she said, downtown. You know, thumb cuffs, piercing jewelry, touching the mask, and these. And a server there to refill their water glasses. Frank stare at the mask on the table. What's that? 18, 19 years old. Faint drift of acne across his forehead beneath a ludicrous hat. For Halloween or something? No, she said. No, it's for sex, a sex toy. And the boy laughed a little, hasty to fill the glasses and be gone. And why'd you have to say that? He said, annoyed. At the workstation, see the boy with another server. Their tandem turned to stare, and she laughed, reached to take the mask and place it back inside the box. No reason, she said, just part of the game. And later in bed, kisses and nipping fingers, but he was waiting. He knew it would come, and reaching for her glass, she retrieved as well the box, secret pleasures and the featureless face within, white face waiting for flesh to fill it, carry it, make it move, and go on, she said. I bought it for you. Put it on. I will if you will. You first. And she helped him adjust it, tie the dangle of strings so the mask lay comfortably close, leather so soft it might have been a second skin. Who am I? Wiped clean of all expression, no mouth to sulk or smile, and her hands now on his face, petting, stroking the mask. You should see how you look. I look like nothing, he said. Strange to feel the movement of muscles when he spoke, feel his lips against the mask like some alien skin. Every man. The boogeyman. And she laughed, leaning back against the pillows, cheekbone flush and reaching to bring his face to her. Your turn, she said. Your turn to be on top. It grew hot inside the mask. He didn't mind. Your turn. Raining outside now. Monotony of thunder and she crabby in quilts. Ugly nightgown and it's your turn, he said again, dangling the mask by its strings. Call from some secret birth, some unborn self. And go on, he said, feeling his erection press his trousers as facial bones might press the mask. A slight straining, the pressure of rising heat. And the mask did not fit her quite as well. Hung slightly beneath her chin, but he tightened the strings again. Ow! More annoyance than real pain, her voice softer somehow because dampered, muffled by the slit, which did not completely meet her lips. "It's too tight," faint her voice, but he left it that way. No portion of her features visible, nothing but faceless white. "Lie down," he said. "Oh, not here." Yet without true complaint, she was not attending. She was feeling the mask with her fingers, curious to press against cheekbones and chin. "And, you know, I tried this on before," more than half to herself. "But not so." "Lie down," he said. Thunder like the echo of a beating heart, giant's heart in rhythm with his own. Pulse of blood and rain on the roof, a clutch of claws. Her body bent obedient on the landscape of the quilts, and afterwards half turned from him. "You hurt me," she said, touching herself. "Don't be so rough." The mask on the floor like a self discarded. No one, anyone, every man. "I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't mean to." The next time he lay below her, masked and silent. "Don't move," that was the game. No matter what, don't move. Clamped thighs. And all at once she bit him, bright teeth in the shoulder hard enough to leave a bruise, nipping and pinching with her nails, scratches on his chest, his back, and he had to fight not to move, not to push her away, to lay absolutely still even as he came, sweep of red pleasure and she above in reckless motion, hair sweat wild and tumbled, panting as if she had no air, and then collapsing down to lie beside him, one leg stretched companionably across his two, thigh high on his hip, and without moving anything but his fingers, he pinched her, quick and brutal on her inner thigh, and in perfect reflex, she slapped him very hard across the face, both sound and impact deadened by the presence of the mask. Neither spoke. Sometime after that, he fell asleep, woke much later to find her curled far across the bed and himself still in the mask. Sweat dried to an itch across his cheekbones, the differing itch of his overnight beard, fingers clumsy with fatigue against the strings. Waking to true morning, he found it crumbled on the floor, spoor and element of dream made to follow the sleeper all the way to the waking world. "I'm sorry," she said. She might have been crying earlier in the shower. She had kept the bathroom door closed. Her eyes were clear but swollen, pink and sore around the lids. "I didn't mean to hit you." "I'm sorry, too," he thought. "Let's forget it," he said, "okay?" The next time they made love, they did not use the mask. Plain faces, closed eyes, and although it was good, with her it was almost always good, still he missed it, the heat within that stasis, visible and not, here and not here, but said nothing, did not mention it at all. He wondered if she missed it, too. Dinner, carry-out tie in little lumps. He had waited too long to leave the office, stuck twice in traffic in a heavy storm. So much rain lately. The food on his plate gone slick and cold, eating alone, clicking through channels and outside another sound, her car in the driveway. Half rising to open the door, let her in, and hi, wet and breathless, hair stuck to her face, and oh good, she said, you got dinner. Side by side on the sofa, and now that she was home, he opened a bottle of wine, two bottles, still on the sofa, and he started to undress her, blouse and bra, hooks and eyes, and wait, she said, voice lightly slurred, just wait a minute. He lay back on the sofa, rain on the roof, and all at once the white face, peering at him, mouth expressionless, but beneath, he knew, a smile. Peekaboo, she said. And inside him, the sudden surge, heat pure and rising like mercury, like the tempo of the storm. And let me wear it, he said, up on one elbow, rising to reach for the strings. Then you can know from above him, pale and remote. It's not your turn. That stare. He could not see her eyes. And inside him then a differing surge, something gray and chilly, like metal, like falling rain. Secret pleasures, between a video store and a deli, glass door opaque, and inside the ratchet and thump of music, steel-toned racks to display the shiny harnesses, leather hoods and thigh-high boots, and below the counter a glass case of jewelry, piercing jewelry like little iron bars, dumbbells, hooks and circles, and can I help you? From a tall, thin boy in leather, boots and jacket head to toe, and masks, he said, I want to see the masks. And after all, it was very easy to say. No doubt the clerks had already seen it all. This boy with his thin cheeks and ragged hair leading him to the display carousel to show him what there was to see. Buckles and loops and ribbon ties, leather and rubber, all faces he might wear, desires he might claim if only for a night, and that one, he said, pointing with the tip of one finger. Let me see that one. Red leather, harsh as meat exposed, no plain oval but the true mask, face-shaped and stitchery like scars, strangely peaked at the eyebrows, and what are those supposed to be, he asked, touching the peaks. Horns? Those are darts, the clerk said, to make it fit tighter. See? In position to his face, buckled on, and the clerk stepped back so he might use the mirror. Eyes kept closed for a moment, wanting tactile information, wanting the feel of the mask before any decision sight might make. This one much tighter than the other, stiffer, more formal. This mask would not fit her at all. And he opened his eyes to the mirror to see himself a stranger. Sex become power, desires become demands, demands given as orders. And when the clerk told him the price, he shrugged a little, more than he meant to spend, but what difference did that make? His credit card on the counter, bright and toy-like, the clerk brushing hair from his eyes. Do you want a box or anything, a gift box? No, he said, just put it in a bag. Raining again and nearly dark as he pulled into the driveway, heart in peculiar race, and he called her name when he entered, made his voice normal, called her name again as he walked through the darkened house with the bag tight in his hand. Room to room, nothing. She was nowhere, so circle back to the living room, silent and dark. Rain like voices to make a chorus, secret chorus in a language all its own as, here I am, her voice very quiet, and then again as if he had not heard, here I am. Past the sofa in the corner where wall met wall, and she was naked and hooded, draped in a hood so shapeless and so black as to give no breath of the female, no hint of the human inside. If there were eye slits, he did not see them. There must be holes for breathing, but in this light he could not be sure. Gaze without words, but an alien shudder, as if some other creature, bullet-shaped, past fathoming, were rising from the fragile flesh of her body, the sloping shelf of shoulders made from bone. The bag made a sound as it touched the floor. His fingers trembled on the straps, the heavy red buckles of the mask. I brought you something, he said. Silence, arms crossed, her breath in hitching motion, both of them waiting for him to strip and cross the room. Well, you must have a lot of questions after that. I will be glad to have questions, anyone who has questions. Or Leslie, you and I can just talk. Well, I did pick the second story as a complimentary piece to the first, just because, for one thing, I think that the idea of flying is a real universal, almost universal, what, fantasy, pipe dream. Everybody wants to fly. Everybody wants to be invisible. What else does everybody want to do? There's something else. There's three of them. There's flight, there's invisible, and there's something else.
Strength? Is it strength?
Yeah, to be a Superman, to be a superhero. But the things, to have something like this actually happen to you, to be able to fly, I thought, what would that really be like? You know, how would you do that? How could you possibly, you know, people would see you, people would talk, people would want to do something to you, you know, lock you up, study you. You know, where does this come from? And that's what made it interesting to me. I mean, he had a granted wish, basically, that he hadn't even known that he made. Sort of like the people in the second story also had granted wishes that they weren't aware of making. One of the things I like to do in my stories is surprise myself and maybe subvert my own expectations of where things are going. There was another story that I was going to read tonight, but it's too long. It's also in here. It's called Reckoning. And in that story, when I started out at point A, I had no idea where I was going to go, and I ended up far from where I thought I was going to be. And I like to do that. I like that as a reader. I like it as a writer. I like it as a viewer of movies, you know, or a listener of music. I want people to surprise me and show me something I've never seen before. And I hope that I can sometimes do that for people and maybe please them that way. Because to me, there's nothing worse than sitting down and watching something or reading something where you know exactly what's going to happen. What's the point? You know, what's the point? Why spend the time? I want to see something new. Leslie and I talked about that a little bit earlier today, and I think what we came up with was where the ideas themselves come from, nobody knows, but where your own response to an idea comes from that might start up a story or a book is probably as idiosyncratic. You know, there are as many answers to that as there are people. I had said to Leslie that I think I notice it most when I'm starting to work on a project, when I'm just starting to get interested in something, all of a sudden I'll start running across things germane to what's going on. If I'm writing about, you know, whatever, geology or elevators, all of a sudden things will come across my path. I'll meet someone who, you know, used to build elevators for a living, or I'll, you know, you should talk to Joe Blow because he's been like a rock hound forever. And those things start coming to you in ways I think that are more than just coincidence. I think you're just suddenly open to it, and that's why you're able to get them. All your antenna are up, and you're getting everything that's out there. But where the original impetus comes from, I don't know. I tend to write the same kind of things that I like to read. That's probably the best answer that I can think of. But where are those, I mean, who knows why you like what you like. The first thing I would say is read everything, even things that are bad, even things that are dumb, everything you can get your hands on that you have the least slightest bit of interest in, especially if it's in a genre or, you know, a kind of writing that you're interested in. Read it all. Read everything. And read outside that, too. Because I do see that's one problem I think sometimes people who work exclusively in genres have. They tend to read too much in their own field. And, you know, it's not like being a neurologist. You're allowed to read other stuff. It won't harm your discipline. But that's read and write. Read and write and write and write and write. And throw a lot of it out. And if you can, find someone who can look at your stuff and give you an honest answer, like not someone who will tell you you're great unless you're really great. It's time for my clarion plug. A long time ago, I went to the clarion workshop at MSU, and it is a cliche, but it did change my life. It completely changed my life. It showed me that someone like me who basically lived in, you know, a dumb little suburb and knew nothing and no one, and had always thought of writers as people who probably were all in New York, and they, you know, had fabulous lives, and it was nothing. I mean, I could write things, but I could never be a writer. I mean, that was just out of the question. That's not something that could happen to me. And when I went to Clarion and I met the writers who were my instructors, they were real people, and they took us all seriously. And they treated us like writers. And it made it possible for me to try to write stories and send them out to the magazines. And it took 4 years from my Clarion summer to my first sale. But I never stopped believing that I could do it after, you know, professionals in my field had said, you can try, sure, certainly. You have just as good a shot as anybody else. And I can't say enough about it. It was quite an experience. I have also never been to a writer's workshop since then, so it's possible that it branded me in some horrible way that I'll never get over. But I know there are other, you know, other lesser workshops out there in the world, and I recommend it very highly. I recommend just the workshop experience is not at all a bad idea. I tend to be a little more suspicious of, even though I'm in one now, in a group, a writing group workshop, simply because sometimes too many of the people in them, it's either turns into people are ripping each other apart for no reason, or everyone is saying, you're just really wonderful. Oh no, you're much better than I am. Oh no, oh, I really loved your story. And that's just worthless to you. You need someone who's gonna read your stuff and say, this is no good, this is no good, this is no good, this is good. Then you can believe them. But as far as like taking writing classes in school, I don't know, because I've never done that. So I can speak highly of the workshop experience, but otherwise I don't know. Sometimes people say they're bad because you start writing like the instructor. I don't know. I think everybody goes through a phase of that. When I do it now, that's why sometimes I won't read books by people who write very strong stuff. The best example I can think of now is Cormac McCarthy, who I think is a really great writer, but I would not dare to read his things before I start writing something of my own, because his voice would just take over mine and I would be writing these, you know, things that would be great, but they wouldn't be mine, they would be his, sort of channeled through me, so that would be no good. But where was I going with this? I had a point. I was trying to make a point. Writing teachers. I don't know. Go to writing workshops. If you don't like them, find another one. Find somebody who can read your stuff and give you honest and brutal critiques. And send stuff out. Send stuff out. Don't be discouraged. Don't ever be discouraged. Because editors all know that what editors really want are people to write things for them that they can like and buy, that are not going to, you know, cost them lots of agony and angst to redo and edit. And they want you to make their jobs easier by writing lots of really great stuff. That's what they're for. That's what you're for. They can't do it without you. It seems like they have all the balance of power, but really the writer has most of the power and none of the money. But they can't do it without us, so that's what we're there for. That's why we're here.
Yeah, it's very common for writers to lead a double professional life. Like they can do the writing on one side, write a book, and have another job. You can have them.
Sure, and I think a lot of people, it probably helps to be younger when you do that and to not have kids. Because once you have a family, that's kind of your job too, and you're sort of, you have to give the time to that. I think sometimes people prefer that because they can be less, they can worry less about, is this going to sell? How fast is it going to sell? How can I market this? How can I get an agent? Blah, blah, blah. You can write things for yourself. You can develop yourself as a writer, I think, a lot better without that kind of pressure. Because I was, after I got out of Clarion, in fact, I had my son, so I was home raising a baby, which was part of the reason I wasn't able to sell a lot of stuff right away, because I didn't have a lot of time to write a lot of stuff right away. I was still writing, but not as much. But I think it's a good idea. I think it's not. What I think would be harder is having a job that's almost like being a writer, but not. Like being an editor or being, now I can't think of any, but you know what I mean, a job that is taking the same kind of, using that same part of your brain. You'd probably be better off being an accountant or digging a ditch or something that's not using your writing brain. Because if you then come home at the end of the day, which is why I have a problem with writing stuff that's almost like writing novels or real stuff, like movie novelizations or things like that. I know people sometimes have to do that to pay the rent. And there's nothing wrong with it, but I think it's harder than to sit down and try to do your own stuff after you've spent, you know, all day with these puppets that aren't your puppets and making them talk. But I have certainly had plenty of jobs that had nothing to do with my own work and they paid money, you know, and they kept me alive. I haven't had a real job since my son was born, knock wood, but I don't think there's anything intrinsically, it's not going to hurt. It probably, and it could help, too, because you never know who you're going to talk to, or who you're going to run into, and what's going to make your antenna stand up. Mary?
Is there a story that you've written that you are especially fond of in retrospect?
Yes, there is, in fact. And it's a story that, for some reason, I am unable to get placed. The two places that I have sent it so far have not been able to use it for reasons that have nothing to do with things that were out of the editor's control. So it hasn't been rejected. It's been bought twice. And I cannot get this thing into print. And it really bugs me because it's called The Oblivion Quartet. And it's a story about, it's basically about animals and the way animals are treated. And this is a big deal for me. I'm very interested in animal rights. And it was a story that was important to me emotionally. And I'm really hacked that I haven't been able to get it into print. And it's about extinction. It's about the way people treat their dogs. It's about experiments on animals. And in fact, the last place that purchased it was a charity anthology. And I was really excited to see it was supposed to benefit an animal shelter in Washington State called PAWS. And unfortunately, the guy, the editor who was putting together the anthology, is not able to get it out and is not able to get it in print because of things that have happened in his own life that have nothing to do with his work. And I'm really bummed. So, yes, I really like that story. I think I was able to get about as close to what I was shooting for as I ever have. Sometimes I look back on my work and I say, oh, I could have done that better. Oh, I wish I hadn't done that, or, you know, whatever. But I was firing on almost all cylinders there, so I'm pretty proud of that. But there are some stories in here. There's a story in here called Reckoning that I like a lot. It's probably my favorite story in the book. Actually, it was a lot of fun putting this together, going through some of my old stories, and because there are ones here from quite a while ago, the late 80s and early 90s. And it was just fun to revisit. It was like looking through a yearbook or a scrapbook. It was kind of neat. In fact, I just had, I forget the title of the book, but an editor had come to me and asked to reprint my first science fiction story, which is a story called Distances. Is my first, technically my first, you know, big professional sale. And would I write a little thing about it? And that was really cool to look back on it and think, well, what would I have done? Because they wanted to know, would you do it any differently? Or, you know, blah, blah, what would you do if you had to rewrite it? And that was kind of fun to look back at it and say, no, I probably do it the same way again. I would probably, given these characters in this situation, it would probably turn out the same way. But it was quite a while ago, and it was good to look at. But that's not in here. I don't know why. I ran out of room, I think. I had more stories than I thought. Yes?
What is more important when you're writing a story? To feel passionately about the subject of the story itself, or about the main character you're writing about?
Well, sometimes they're both, you know? I mean, sometimes the person is kind of embodies what you're trying to say. Probably for me it would be the person, because that's how I generally write my stories and novels. I see a person first, and I'm most concerned with how that person lives, and then everything else comes after that. Sometimes I have a person and nothing to do with them, and so I can't write a story. I just have this cool person that I made up. But I think it's important to care a lot about what you're trying to say. I don't like to say it like that, what you're trying to say. You know, like we're not trying to write pamphlets. You know, we're not trying to make that kind of a statement with our work. But it is important to have something that you want to tell people, maybe more than something you want to say. Like, you're not trying to make a point. You're trying to say, hey, this is what I think. And it's like anything else. When it's more interesting to listen to someone who's excited about what they have to say than about someone who doesn't really care. When, you know, when your friend grabs you and says, oh my God, I just saw this movie and you have to see it's really good, it's about this guy. You know, you're paying more attention than if you say, yeah, I went to the movies. Yeah, I don't know, it was about a guy. You know, you don't really care. If you don't care, then I don't care either. But if you're really excited about it and you're very passionate about it, you're gonna get your point. People are gonna listen to you no matter what you're talking about because you have enthusiasm and your enthusiasm is gonna drag them in whether they like it or not. In fact, sometimes, even in reading a magazine like The New Yorker, I'll start reading an article about something I don't even care about. But because the person obviously cares so much, they're making me care, whether I want to or not, and I'll get to the very end of it and go, they had, just for an example, they had this big, long article about this guy who made an ice machine that can be, that replaces, like, ice factories or places where they have ice, and they used to have to cut up ice and bring it to, physically bring it to party stores. And this guy said, there's got to be a better way. So he invented an ice machine that makes ice right on the premises. And this was like a huge bombshell to the ice industry, and everyone was up in arms. And I'm reading this thing and going, God, this is so interesting, and I don't even care. But I did care, and he made me care, because he was a really good writer. So that, yes, that's my answer. Do whatever he did, and people will care, because they don't have a choice. I think one of the things people talk about and say, oh, people don't read, or people don't like to read, people like to hear stories. Everybody likes to hear stories. Everybody likes to tell stories. That's why sometimes people will ask in interviews and stuff and say, oh, do you think the internet is going to kill books? Do you think e-publishing is going to kill books? I really don't care. You know, I don't, that has nothing to do with what I do. I don't, the format to me doesn't mean anything. I would like it in the kind of format that's the most accessible to the biggest amount of people. And I don't have any particular brief for paper. And it's probably better not to kill so many trees and have a lot of books, you know, sent back to the publishers to be remaindered that are just wrecked and pulped. It's probably a lot, ecologically, it's a lot better. It doesn't matter what delivery system we use. Everybody needs to hear stories. Everybody wants to tell stories. I mean, what do you do when something happens to you that's really exciting or really, or you almost got in an accident or something really weird happened in school? The first thing you want to do is tell somebody about it. Even if you tell your journal, even if you tell someone, you write an email, you want to tell someone. You want to say, I can't believe what that bastard did, or oh my God, that guy almost killed me. That's a human impulse. That's very old. Especially if it's your mother. Especially if it's your mother who did it to you. Yes, that's very, very germane to the human condition. Everybody wants to hear and tell stories. And so I don't think it makes a bit of difference how they're told. I don't think it's going to change anything. It's like, I imagine people said when they stopped telling, physically telling stories, well, there's the end of storytelling. You know, there won't be any more stories now that we're not sitting around the fire anymore. It's all dead. It's over. You know, they couldn't possibly have foreseen how great it is for people. My books have been published in a variety of countries, and none of which I have ever been to. And so people in those countries are able to see my stuff. And it doesn't matter if they ever see me. It doesn't matter, you know, if I'm living or dead. It just, they get to see things and read things of mine the same way I get to see and read things that are translated for writers I'll never meet. But it doesn't matter. I don't have to meet them. We don't have to be around the fire anymore. We can be around that fire. It's just as good. It's better. Because more people can sit around the fire and talk about it afterwards. There's my statement. I get tired though. Some writers will say that and will kind of whine about it, and you know, it's not going to hurt anything. Don't be afraid. It'll be better. And that said, I do prefer to read things on paper than on the screen. But I think that's partially a function of age. My son is 16, and he would much rather read things on the screen. So maybe that's just me. But that was kind of my big statement about e-publishing. I think it has a long way to go. I don't know what kind of format it's going to end up being. It's going to have to be something better than the little rocket books and stuff, which are stupid and clumsy. But that'll change. that'll change, and it'll be something that can compete with a paperback book for portability and cheapitude, and we'll all have them, and we'll like them. We won't imagine how we ever got along without them. I mean, it's like, why do most people get computers? So they can get email. Everybody wants to get email. People who have no use for a computer. My parents, they want to get online. They want to find, well, not my mother, but my dad. My dad wants to find out about stuff and to get email and to see the world. And that's what, that's it. Then they want to play games too, but we won't talk about that. But I think that's part of what writing is supposed to be about too. It's a way of seeing the world, of seeing all the world, of seeing things you could never experience, things you would never want to experience. I mean, I don't particularly want to be these people that I just read about. It sounds pretty nasty, but I'm interested in them. I don't really want to fly. I'm afraid of heights. But I'm interested in him, and that's why I read books, too, because I want to have every possible experience that I can have without actually, you know, having to stand up in my house. Are there any more questions?
Who's your favorite author?
Oh, probably right now, Cormac McCarthy. I think he's really great. He's the kind of writer that I can read with my jaw dropping. I think the first book of his I ever read it's a book called Outer Dark, and I read it in the trade edition. It's like, I don't know, 150 pages. I mean, it's this little, skinny little book, and he starts off with this brother and sister who are just as stupid as a bag of rocks. And they've had this incestuous child, and the brother tells the sister he killed it and buried it in the woods, and the sister doesn't believe him. And so she goes off. She thinks it was stolen by this itinerant tinker. So she takes off after this tinker looking for her baby. And then he cuts to these three guys who are like incarnate evil and sets them in motion. And they're just killing everybody in sight on the little hamlets they drive through. They're killing everyone. And you start seeing that what he's going to do is bring these stupid half-wit brother and sister, because she goes after the baby and then he goes after her, and he's going to make them meet up with these horrible people. And they're so stupid. You know something horrible is going to happen, like a train wreck. And he does all this in like less than 200 pages. It's just amazing. It's called Outer Dark. It's so good. So that's probably the last best book that I read that just blew me away. It was the kind of book that it's a cliche. I did not put it down. I didn't want to put it down. I didn't want to go to the bathroom. I wanted to see what he was going to do with, especially once I realized that these two were going to have to collide. And the girl especially, she's so dumb. She's just so dumb. And she's not the kind of person you think you would care about. In real life, you would go miles out of your way not to have to talk to her. But in this story, you really care what is happening to her, and you want her to be okay, and that's why he's so cool. You had a question too.
Yeah. Have you ever felt the need to limit the content of your short stories because it might be something that you're afraid of, or you feel like sometimes you really want to write, but it might be somehow socially unacceptable, and therefore you should not write about it?
I have thought about that, but no. I never have. What I have done is limit some of the things that I'm willing to read in public, especially things that I'm willing to read in a bookstore. Not so much a setting like this, because everybody here is a grown-up and everybody here has had to kind of come here on purpose. But I've been in bookstores where people have done readings that, to me, are inappropriate. I mean, some people are in there just to get a cookbook or a calendar or something, and, you know, and some one starts reading from their serial killer manuscript or, you know, their whatever. And I don't think that's right, because you're inflicting yourself on people. It's like being next to a noisy drunk. I mean, you know, I didn't come here for that. I came here to get a drink. I don't want to listen to that. I don't think there's any limit. Probably the only thing I would worry about, and in fact, I just talked to a friend of mine about this the other day. We weren't arguing, but we were trying to figure out what was the right thing to do. She wanted to read a poem of hers that would offend the woman whose experience was written about in the poem. There's, you know, naming no names, but the woman would know definitely it was her. And she was wondering, should I read this at this place where she's likely to be? I really want to read it. They want me to read it, but should I do it? She's going to be really hacked off. She might get up and leave. I mean, I don't know what to do. And so we kicked that around for a while with no answer. I don't know. I would be a little bit worried about using my family's experiences. I would probably do it anyway, but I would worry about it and feel bad. I feel guilty afterwards, but I would probably do it. I don't know that. I think you have natural limits to what, certainly there are limits to what I can do, not only what I'm able, what I allow myself to do, but what I can do. There's just certain types of material I can't handle that I'm not, it's just not anything I can do anything with. I've been solicited from time to time to write a certain kind of story for an anthology or something, and I have to say no, because I either I don't like it, or I'm not interested in it, or I try it and I can't make heads or tails out of it. I think we're naturally limited by our own talents in any kind of, you know, creative, in any endeavor, you're limited by what you can do. And certainly if I was a better writer, there are other things I could do, but I can't. But I try not to limit myself if I can help it, because the world will do it for me, and my own talent or lack of it will do it for me. But I don't think there's anything you can't write about. I don't think there's anything you can't write about. It's if you're a human being and you can think of it, you can write it. You should say that's fair? Fair statement? I think so. Are we done? Is there more?